This is VOA's International Edition. Widespread condemnation of North Korea's nuclear test. The plot thickens over disappearing Hong Kong booksellers.
Snatching people off the street is more than just mere intimidation. It not only offends the press, but it offends the rule of law in Hong Kong.
Safer polio vaccines on the way. An electronics extravaganza plays it big in Las Vegas. These stories are more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. North Korea's claim of another successful nuclear detonation, its first hydrogen test, is drawing international condemnation. The UN Security Council is drawing up new sanctions against North Korea. Following an emergency session Wednesday, the Security Council said North Korea's actions posed a clear threat to international peace and security. Criticism also came from China, North Korea's closest ally. The Chinese Foreign Ministry said it firmly opposes such a test, did not know in advance it was coming, and will lodge a protest. Britain says it's joined China in calling for a resumption of six-party talks aimed at the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. In Washington, the White House also sharply criticized North Korea, promising to study the nature of the apparent test and respond appropriately. The seismic strength of the test was initially set at 5.1 magnitude on the Richter scale. RAND Corporation nuclear analyst Bruce Bennett told International Edition's Victor Beatty he is doubtful it was a hydrogen bomb blast, as claimed by the North.
Their third nuclear test, which most people think was in the range of about 6 to 10 kilotons or smaller than the Hiroshima blast, was a 4.9 on the Richter scale. This one is reported as a 5.1. That number might get adjusted, but given the scale is logarithmic, that means this one was about 1.5 times as powerful as the last one. So it takes it barely up to the level of the Hiroshima blast, roughly speaking. That's not too impressive for a fourth nuclear test. Most countries who get to a fourth test do considerably better than that. And if this is a hydrogen bomb, should have been somewhere between 10 and 100 times as big.
So they're hyping it, in your view?
They're clearly hyping it. Now, one possibility is that it could be what is called a boosted weapon. In a boosted weapon, which is an early generation of working with fusion, the hydrogen bomb material, you only add a little bit of fusion material to the bomb, and it makes it more efficient. And so they could have been trying to do that, but even if they were trying to do that, they should have been at least 5 to 10 times bigger than their last test, and they're not. So either their fusion element failed or their fission element acted really poorly, like back along the lines of the first or second test, for them to come out in the kind of size range we're hearing, unless that gets adjusted.
Sung Yoon Lee, a Korea expert at Tufts University, views the latest test as an effort to squeeze more concessions out of the global community.
We know North Korea has a propensity to resort to these things, major provocations. In the first half of the calendar year, raising the stakes, then in the second half of the calendar year, launching sort of a peace offensive with a view toward reaping concessions just for de-escalation and creating the illusion of crisis averted. And North Korea has been very good at playing this game over the past 25 years. It's reaped, by my calculation, at least $20 billion from China, South Korea, and the United States. This is a particularly opportune time because North Korea likely calculates that this decades-old cycle of provocations, negotiations, extorting concessions that has brought it billions of dollars will work once again against democratically elected leaders who come and go with each election cycle, especially those nearing the end of their term.
What will South Korea's response likely be?
Usually there's a lot of rhetorical condemnation. This is unacceptable. this is an unacceptable provocation, this is provocative, there will be penalties, there will be some action at the UN Security Council. So far, there have been 5 or 6 strongly worded UN Security Council resolutions with a view toward penalizing North Korea for its provocations, long-range missile tests and nuclear tests. Those are effective, those are helpful. But they have not deterred North Korea's march toward nuclear breakout, because while China signs on to those UN Security Council sanctions, China behind the scenes has gradually increased its aid to North Korea.
Sung-Yoon Lee, Korean expert at Tufts University, says he is bewildered that targeted financial sanctions, which have proven to be effective to change North Korean behavior in the past, have not yet been reimposed by the United States. He spoke with International Edition's Victor Beatty. The North Korean nuclear test is buzzing online. International Edition's G. Abby Lee joins me in the studio with the latest. Hello, G.
Hi, Ray. The breaking news is that the U.S. government is questioning Pyongyang's claims about the hydrogen bomb test. As you know, North Korea on Wednesday reported its 4th nuclear test and claimed it was a hydrogen bomb. But it turns out that claim may not be true.
North Korea exaggerating its nuclear capabilities is really nothing new in the world of news. So what's the response so far on the internet?
Well, for that, let's check out a New York Times article. The NYT was one of the first media outlets to break the news. It shared a link to the article on its Facebook page. The Facebook post reads like this. The White House says the initial data from its monitoring stations in Asia were not consistent with North Korea's claim that the nuclear test it carried out earlier in the day was its first test of a hydrogen bomb.
Well, that's quite a bold statement. Gee, tell us, if you can, about some of the comments to that article.
Sure. One of the comments highlighted by the NYT is by a reader in Pennsylvania. He wrote, "I don't understand why our leaders in government have been so focused on Iran's potential to develop a nuclear bomb when North Korea, a completely rogue nation run by a madman, already has it." Another reader in Illinois wrote this. "How much food, heat, and shelter could the cost of that H-bomb provide to North Korean people?" Another reader in Florida wrote a rhetorical question, asking, "With all our satellites, shouldn't we be able to tell if there was a hydrogen bomb set off?" Ray, before I go, I want to say a big thank you for being an amazing colleague to work with in the past few months, and that I wish you the best. That's all for me today.
Thanks, G. You can follow her on Twitter at G Abby Lee, that's JEEABBEYLEE, or at our program's account at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
The news never stops. So keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. Iraq's foreign minister is offering to act as a mediator between its neighbors Iran and Saudi Arabia. Relations deteriorated rapidly after the Saudi execution of prominent Shiite cleric Nimr al-Nimr on Saturday, followed by angry protesters storming the Saudi embassy in Tehran and Saudi Arabia's subsequent decision to cut off diplomatic ties with Iran. Russia is also showing a willingness to act as an intermediary. Moscow correspondent Daniel Scharf spoke about the development with International Edition Susan Yaki.
It's not an official offer in terms of it having been publicly announced, but what we do have are sources in Russia's foreign ministry, who've been quoted in Russian state media and also in foreign media as saying that they have made this offer. So it is out there. They seem to be just kind of feeling it out to see if they may be able to provide this kind of a service for the two sides or if they would be interested in it. But it has not been officially announced in terms of, really putting it out there for everyone.
Well, this is a little awkward situation because of Russia's relationship with Iran and Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, Russia's been playing this kind of intermediary role to a degree already with the Syria conflict in terms of, trying to get the different sides to the table and really pushing for this grand coalition that it would like to see happen that would include Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. But that's the big sticking point between the two sides, of course, because Saudi Arabia wants to see the Syrian president removed from power. They want him to get out of the equation. They believe he's, along with the United States, they believe that he is a big cause of the problem in Syria, whereas Iran is backing him up, and of course Moscow is, because that's their ally.
Yeah, and Russia's been selling arms to Iran.
Yep, they've been a longtime customer of Russian arms sales. We've also seen that stepped up a little bit in terms of wanting to get a particular advanced missile system that they had agreed to some years ago, get that deal hashed out. That's run into some legal problems just between Russia and Iran, but it looks like with the settlement of the nuclear deal that they're going to be able to get that all sorted out. But that, of course, has raised some concerns among Iran's neighbors, such as Israel, and the United States is not so keen to see advanced missile systems go to Iran either. But, of course, Iran has its own ballistic missiles that are being developed, and that's a big concern as well.
This conflict between Iran and Saudi Arabia has had ripple effects all through the Middle East. Where does Russia come into this big picture?
Well, Russia certainly wants to get out there and be a big player. Russia wants to be seen as being at the table as not only a regional power, but also as a global power. Of course, Russia does want to see a peaceful settlement to the conflict in Syria because it has its own concerns, not only about its ally in Damascus, but also because there are thousands of Russian citizens who have been fighting alongside the Islamic State terrorists. And there is a concern here in Moscow that when the conflict does come to an end, or if it gets further out of hand, or if they decide to target Russia, that they could come back home and bring some of those fundamentalist militant ideas back to Russia. So that's a big concern as well.
VOA Moscow correspondent Daniel Scharf speaking with my colleague Susan Yockey. It's one thing when a book disappears from the shelves when it's popular. It's something else when the bookseller vanishes. Five booksellers have mysteriously disappeared in Hong Kong. British officials are pressing the Chinese government to explain what's going on. Shannon Van Zandt reports.
Freedom of the press in Hong Kong dominated British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond's two-day trip to Beijing Wednesday, as the mystery of the missing Hong Kong booksellers deepened this week. Britain gave control of the former British colony back to China in 1997, with the promise that the Chinese government would maintain a one-country, two-systems model for the special administrative region. Secretary Hammond commented on the disappearance of Li Bo, a publisher of books critical of China's leaders, who vanished in Hong Kong last week.
Li Po, who is a British passport holder, has gone missing, and we have urgently inquired both of the Hong Kong authorities and of the mainland Chinese authorities what, if anything, they know of his whereabouts.
65-year-old Li is a shareholder of Causeway Bay Books, a store that sells books about the private lives of Chinese leaders. This week, Taiwan's central news agency published a letter purportedly written by Li that said he had gone to mainland China voluntarily to work with concerned parties. Subsequently, his wife, Sophie Choi, withdrew a missing persons report for her husband on Monday. Michael Davis is a professor at Hong Kong University.
Snatching people off the street is more than just mere intimidation. It not only offends the press, but it offends the rule of law in Hong Kong, because people in Hong Kong are guaranteed freedom of the press.
Li is the fifth man linked to a publishing company, Mighty Current, to go missing since October. The four other associates have been unaccounted for since then. Tom Leander of the Society of Publishers in Asia expressed concern at what he says is a lack of resolve by the Hong Kong government and Chief Executive C.Y. Leung to defend the city's autonomy and rule of law.
I know C.Y. Leung has said that it's unconstitutional that a bookseller would be taken by police without the Hong Kong police knowing it over the border. However, he hasn't come out and made any more direct references to the situation, and he has not approached Beijing directly about it. It's a difficult situation because part of Hong Kong's attraction is its rule of law and its freedom of the press.
Recent weeks, Chinese media published editorials critical of Li's publishing company, saying that it maliciously fabricated content and caused an evil influence in mainland China. The Chinese government has not offered any information on the whereabouts of the missing booksellers. When questioned about the case, Chinese officials have said that any citizen born in Hong Kong of Chinese descent is a citizen of China and warned against interference by other countries in China's internal affairs. Shannon Van Sant for VOA News, Hong Kong.
A series of weather disasters has shaken the world in recent weeks, with deadly floods in the United States and Britain adding to ongoing and devastating droughts in Brazil, South Africa, and India. VOA's Michael Lippin examined the causes of the extreme weather with a panel of climate observers in this week's hashtag VOA TV program and joins us now in the studio. Michael, how did the panelists explain what in the world's going on?
Well, thanks, Ray. You know, we talked about two major climate phenomena in the show, one being global warming, which has been going on for years, and the other being El Niño, which is a natural periodic warming of the eastern Pacific Ocean that can last a year or two. Now, the latest El Niño started a few months ago, and it's proved particularly strong this year. One of the panelists in the show was Jeff Masters. He's the director of meteorology at Weather Underground, which is a U.S. online news service. He joined us via Skype and said that rising temperatures linked to global warming and El Niño could be to blame for freak disasters like those floods you mentioned in the American Midwest and northern Britain.
We have to understand that if you've got a warmer planet with warmer oceans, you're going to get a lot more evaporation off those oceans. So now with a warmer atmosphere, you've got more energy to power bigger storms. So when it does rain, you're going to see more of those high-end societal impactful events.
And Michael, who else appeared on the show?
Well, Ray, we had another panelist. His name was Robert Finney, the author of Robert Scribbler, which is a popular U.S. blog about environmental issues. I asked Finney about another highly unusual weather event from last month, which was the temperature at the North Pole briefly rising above freezing in the middle of winter. Finney said that the Arctic heat wave is melting sea ice and creating a kind of feedback effect.
The loss of sea ice turns a white reflective surface to a dark heat-absorbing surface. And so during the summertime, the Arctic Ocean is sucking up a lot more heat from the solar rays. And over time, it re-radiates that heat over the fall and into the winter. And that's a really big impact. That's a new impact that we're seeing.
I'd imagine Arctic wildlife is being affected by that. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. You know, it's having a particularly big impact on polar bears, who rely on that shrinking ice to live, hunt, and breed. Now, Polar Bears International, it's a U.S. and Canadian nonprofit group dedicated to conserving the animals, it says their numbers are dropping. The group's chief scientist, Stephen Amstrup, who also spoke to us via Skype, said that he expects more of the animals to disappear even if the international community limits global warming to 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, as they agreed in last month's Paris climate conference.
The impacts would be significant, and we would lose polar bears over much of their current range. But it's a lot more than polar bears. People say, well, polar bears live way up north, and why should I care? They're just really harbingers of what's coming to the rest of us.
The climate observers say what's coming in 2016 could be more human losses to extreme weather as global warming and El Niño continue to fuel each other in the coming months.
It's fascinating stuff. Thanks, Michael. Where can we find the show online?
Well, I'm glad you asked, Ray. Just go to our hashtag VOA Facebook page, and you'll find it right there.
Still to come, electronic gadgets galore in Las Vegas. This is VOA. This is VOA's International Edition. The goal of eliminating polio worldwide is within sight, but public health officials must make sure that vaccines administered after that point cannot cause a recurrence of the disease. Researchers in Britain have come up with a safe strain that would prevent polio reinfection. VOA's Jessica Berman has more.
Polio vaccines are stockpiled for use into the foreseeable future to prevent another epidemic of paralytic polio once the disease is officially eradicated. Experts say there is always a chance the live weakened virus used to make the warehouse drugs risking new cases of polio. There have also been instances in which mutated viral strains survive in the gut of immune-compromised people after they've been vaccinated. At the urging of the World Health Organization, British researchers have developed safe seed strains from which to make polio vaccine. They modified viral RNA to make the resulting strains genetically stable. The strains that are now used have, in rare cases, mutated into dangerous forms. Vaccines made from the new seed strains would not pose a health hazard at manufacturing facilities, nor be dangerous if they entered into the environment, according to British National Institute for Biological Standards and Control Virology Division head Philip Miner. He helped develop the new strains for polio vaccine, which researchers describe in the journal PLOS Pathogens.
In the very end game period, more inactivated polio vaccine will be used because that's what you need to do to make sure that you haven't missed anything, if you like. And certainly WHO are very keen on getting more and more manufacturers to make this stuff. So if you do that and you use a very much safer strain, I think you're a bit more secure than if you go with what we have at the moment.
Vaccine is now made from live weakened virus. Miner says the new vaccines would be as effective but safer than current vaccine. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
The 2016 Consumer Electronics Show is running this week in Las Vegas, Nevada. Virtual reality technology, robotics, super high definition televisions, and automotive concepts are on the agenda for exploration and explanation. Here's International Edition's David Byrd.
This year's Consumer Electronics Show is expected to highlight more of the Internet of Things, with devices and delivery systems taking center stage. Robin Raskin is the founder of Living in Digital Times. She says that the sprawling display of electronics shows that what was once fantasy is becoming reality.
Just from a year ago, it's like all the building block pieces have come together towards artificial intelligence, robotics, drones, driverless cars. That was all like sort of science fiction hype just a year ago at CES, virtual reality, and this year it's all real. It's somewhat terrifying, but really exhilarating also.
One time, virtual reality was for gaming only, but now designers and manufacturers have used 360-degree cameras to give viewers a truly immersive real-life experience. Henry Stewart is the co-founder of Visualize, a London-based company that gives users views of events they could not have imagined just last year.
And we capture that by using 360-degree cameras that are essentially balls of cameras, different kinds of cameras for different jobs. And these all capture video at once. We then synchronize the cameras, stitch and blend all the content, and produce a sphere which you can then put into virtual reality in a virtual reality headset and immerse yourself in it and look around.
Stewart's company has produced videos that feature a rock band in concert, a passenger's eye view of a Lamborghini driving the coast of Italy, and what it's like from the outside of London's building, The Shard.
And so you've got this 36-hour time-lapse looking over London, seeing the clouds rush in, seeing the weather change, seeing the day and the night cycle, and it's really stunning. And so for The Shard, it means that they can go to tourism expos around the world and encourage tourism, you know, to visit and see this incredible view for yourself.
Robots are expected to make a big splash at this year's CES as well. In the past, many of the robots have been more toy-like, but Robin Raskin says designers are rolling out concepts for robots that are more like personal assistants.
And I'm thinking of an aging population saying, go get that bottle or open this jar for me, or can you help me take my blood pressure? So you're going to see really useful robots, physician's assistant robots, articulating arms, manufacturing. So the practical uses of robotics as well as the entertaining ones.
And auto lovers can look for the latest in automotive technology this week, including more advances toward driverless or autonomous cars. Faraday Future made a splash with its concept car, the FF01, which utilizes the company's variable platform architecture, the same undercarriage and batteries that can be modified for a variety of vehicles, from a race car to an SUV. Nick Sampson is Faraday's Senior Vice President of Research and Development and Product Development.
Over the past 18 months, we've assembled an extraordinary group of over 550 talented individuals in California, plus 200 more globally. We're working literally night and day to reimagine, rethink, and create an entirely new concept for mobility.
The 2016 Consumer Electronics Show runs through January 9th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news, features, videos, and podcasts on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The U.S. Department of State's Rewards for Justice program is offering rewards for information leading to six key leaders of the Somalia-based terrorist organization Al-Shabaab. The U.S. Secretary of State has authorized rewards of up to $6 million for information on the whereabouts of Abu Abeda Diriya, up to $5 million each for information on Mahad Karate, Ma'alim Daoud, and Hassan Afguye, and up to $3 million each for information on Ma'alim Salman and Ahmed Imam Ali. Since 2006, Al-Shabaab has killed thousands of civilians, aid workers, and peacekeepers in Somalia, Uganda, and Kenya. Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for the July 11, 2010 suicide bombings in Kampala, Uganda, which killed more than 70 people, including one American citizen. Al-Shabaab also claimed responsibility for the September 21st through 24th, 2013 terrorist attack against the Westgate shopping mall in Nairobi, which left more than 60 people dead and nearly 200 wounded, and the April 2, 2015 attack on Garissa University College in Kenya, which resulted in 150 deaths. The U.S. Secretary of State designated Al-Shabaab a foreign terrorist organization on March 18, 2008. In February 2012, Al-Shabaab and the Al-Qaeda terrorist network jointly announced they had formed an alliance. Abu Abeda, also known as Diriya, was named the leader of Al-Shabaab on September 6, 2014, after the death of former Al-Shabaab Emir Ahmed Abdi Al-Mohammed, otherwise known as Guadagne. Mahad Karate, also known as Abdirrahman Mohammed Warsameh, has played a key role in Al-Shabaab's assassination operations in the April 2nd attack on Garissa University College. Ma'alim Daoud is responsible for Al-Shabaab's planning, recruitment, training, and operations against the government of Somalia and Western targets. Hassan Afguye oversees Al-Shabaab's financial activities, ranging from fake charities and fundraising to racketeering and kidnapping. Ma'alim Salman leads Al-Shabaab's African foreign terrorist fighters and has been involved in attacks against tourists, entertainment establishments, and churches in Africa. Ahmed Imam Ali has recruited Kenyan youth and raised funds for Al-Shabaab. Anyone with information on these terrorist leaders should contact the nearest U.S. embassy or the Rewards for Justice office via the website at www.rewardsforjustice.net or by email at info@rewardsforjustice.net. Individuals in North America can call this phone number, 1-800-877-3927.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.